So, I presume we've all caught up finally on this remarkable novel, and that you found yourself in an alcove to read the last 80 pages in, just sealed yourself off from the world, because it's utterly, utterly engrossing, and gives to us the notion of what a great work of art does, because it does not tell us something that we can carry away from the novel. Clearly, it leaves us with a number of mysteries, but with a sense of wonder that Dostoevsky has carefully and powerfully led us toward at the end. So today, I wanted, you know, some last comments from me and from you on the prince himself, especially. Although the novel is also about so many other things, and I thought we could bring in some of those many, many other things by looking at a few of the key scenes in the last half of the novel. As the quiz indicated, Dostoevsky has a propensity for those carnivalistic gathering scenes, and of course he has a real climax of a party scene in this in part four. Climaxed in a way that we hope will never occur again in the history of parties by the prince himself. But we have ideology mixed in, right? Whole statements of ideology, analytic interpretations of the state of civilization, of analyses of Mishkin himself. Right, so the novel is, in a sense, a comment on itself. Right, Dostoevsky, and we recall, if you've read Crime and Punishment, what a tight novel that was. How all those same resources that he uses in The Idiot are there in a nutshell, but they're tightly controlled. Right. I stressed the kind of an Aristotelian arc almost that Crime and Punishment has. And of course there's ideology in Crime and Punishment. It plays an absolutely central and integral part in the plot and the development of our main character, Raskolnikov. There is even an article within the novel, right? But that's crucial that it be quoted, that we know what Raskolnikov thinks that leads him to commit the murder of the old pawnbroker woman. It's cause and effect, you know, very powerful, but very unperplexing in the way that things perplex so much in The Idiot. In Crime and Punishment, we're made to see that truth that Richard Weaver stated in the title of his book, Ideas Have Consequences, right? Because we're constantly being petted and reassured that, oh, it's, don't worry about your idea. Experiment with your ideas. All things are free and open areas of inquiry, but in fact, ideas do have consequences, especially when they're held with the kind of firmness that a Bazarov or a Raskolnikov has. But they also can have consequences in this much more vague world of Mishkin. So it's as though. You remember how hard it was to write Crime and Punishment and how quickly he wrote it. It's as though once he had achieved that plateau and he said to himself, you know, well now. Well now, we have you know, a certain freedom to write. Let's go ahead and try for something. Right? And no longer to live within that tight sense of control, but to explore, you know, what the novel can do. What resources are there to show the world that he's trying to paint? And as I've suggested, I think we make best sense of The Idiot not to see it primarily as a portrait of a single character, but first of all to think of the enveloping action as we know Dostoevsky thinks of it. It was as a moment of crisis in the life of the soul of Russia. This is already a notion in that he is taken and developed from Gogol and intensified from Gogol. A moment of crisis, a kairos, in which the future of Russia is at stake. Will it have strength and conviction, potency, fertility, all these things that are asked of a people from time immemorial? Those kind of basic questions, not perhaps primary. Primary are not necessarily the most refined questions, right? Liberty and justice for all, and so forth. Right. But with the novelist's view, he's looking at the whole people, and not merely their most enshrined ideals. And within that enveloping action, then the beginning makes sense, with the train rocketing into Petersburg, coming in with these two polar opposite figures. And the question of what their impact is going to be on Petersburg. And I've then further gone on to suggest perhaps a more daring suggestion that the whole novel really revolves around a marriage, right? And a marriage for a highly ambiguous and mysterious character, Nastasya Philipovna. And that Mishkin himself seems in some ways, and we must decide exactly whether this works or not, but is he intended for her? If so, by whom? Does he fit the archetype of the bridegroom? Is he meant to be the bridegroom for her? What is he missing? What in the plural, perhaps, is he missing? How many things is he missing that would be needed for this to take place? What already is he facing with Nastasya herself? Why is she so damaged? Right. And what are we to make of that? What are we to make of all the minor characters who revolve around them both? But yes, go ahead.
I'm a little confused about the character of Nastasya because of something I heard in two different lectures, and I don't remember if it was the same one of you in each lecture or not, because I only write the date, not who's talking. Unfortunately, I should learn from that. But I remember you saying...
I'm the one with the Fort Worth accent. Okay, go ahead.
I remembered at the beginning we talked about... Nastasya and how maybe Mishkin's problem with both her and Marie in Switzerland was saying, it's not your fault, instead of go and sin no more.
Mm-hmm.
But then yesterday we talked about, not yesterday, last week, we talked about Nastasya being, having been sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
And a sacrificial lamb kind of figure. And so I'm thinking, which is it? Is it her fault? Or is she like a Sonya who is completely forced into this and it's virtually out of her control?
Mm.
How much are we supposed to think she's to blame for the situation?
Mm. Good. All right. Yes, you want to respond to that.
Okay,
good.
I think Aglaya does a really good job of drawing this out, that scene where she goes to see Nastasya.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you could have been a washerwoman, you could have, but you never actually overthrew this life. And she's right. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Nastasya allows, even though she's not living with Tolstoy anymore, she allows him to continue to support her, and she
mm-hmm.
does run away with all these other men. And so maybe the initial, when she's 12 years old and she's 12, right? Like when Tosky first sort of takes her out of her family environment and kind of, when she's a child, to some degree, I don't think Dostoevsky's saying it's her fault when she's 12 years old and Tosky shows up at the house. But I think it is her fault for continuing,
yeah.
Down that path.
That's what I would think, okay.
right.
And I think that's the distinction he's making there. Because she almost like Ippolit, who, you know, sees the difference, willfully rolls herself down a path of sin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And she does it to save Mishkin, but does that make her choice any less?
Okay, yes.
On page 614, Adalia is talking to Nastasya, and I think she says something that's really true. She says, "You could love nothing," it's the very bottom, "you could love nothing but your shame and the continual thought that you've been brought to shame and done an injury. If your shame were less or entirely gone altogether, you would be more unhappy."
Yes.
And it's she uses her shame as her power platform, which is sick.
Yes, well, there's that.
And that's
yes.
why she's so manipulative and never wants to let go of it, because she knows that to a certain degree that's where all of her strength lies.
Mm-hmm.
So
in her shame lies her strength?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, but in a chaotic sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was just thinking about Lebedev, his character, even, I don't remember where it is, but he's sort of, you know, he always sending these notes in between people and says, always saying, "I am to blame, it is my fault. I know how bad I am." And he doesn't use those excuses. I mean, he uses his own guilt as an excuse for what he's done, as sort of a mode of pity. Saying that he's guilty makes other characters, he wants the other characters to excuse him, first of all, because of that. But I don't understand it so much in Nastasya, because she is seemingly supposed to be a lovable, good character. But it's as though she holds on to her shame as a kind of trophy, even in like a similar way that Lebedev does it. But in Lebedev, he's such a detestable character.
Mm-hmm.
And for she, I just think that relationship is sort of an odd one, especially when Nastasya is such a good character as well. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Sorry, does that make sense? I didn't express that very well.
I'm tempted to say my response to this is, you know, what a good psychologist Dostoevsky is. I think you've analyzed that, or you brought out that situation very well. Any other comments on?
I just had a question. In that last confrontation between Nastasya and Aglaya, Aglaya says something about like calling her a loose woman. And then Nastasya's like, "Am I a loose woman? Ask Rogozhin if I'm a loose woman." So it's kind of like this confusion of whether or not she's actually living this life of sin.
Yes.
Or just kind of seeming like it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean,
it's entirely possible that she's completely denied Rogozhin this entire time, because he's so completely at her feet. Mm-hmm. So that struck me too, as a moment where, oh, well, could be entirely different matter. But again, by that point, that's almost a detail. Yeah. I did want to say something real quickly. They brought up the analogy of Sonya in Crime and Punishment. This, again, is just for us Crime and Punishment readers. But Sonya admits freely that she's a sinner.
Yes.
Okay. So it's not that she's in some special category of...
Oh, no, but that seems to almost mitigate her blame to some level.
Mm-hmm.
That she has some kind of humility.
True. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so you can see the incredible vertiginous difference between her and Nastasya for that reason. Mm-hmm. But there's something nonetheless, and it goes back to the mythic roots of Russia, right? Of old Holy Russia, Holy Mother Russia, in being this wounded, victimized, suffering woman that makes you a figure that should be the focus of everyone, that should be, in a sense, redemptive for others.
Is somehow redemptive of yourself, or...?
No, of others. I mean, and that's why everyone looks to Nastasya. And she could be. Right. But you know, in this, in the world that is given, there's no one to step forward and do that. Yes. Uh-huh.
It seems strange to me how the prince is like really obsessed with suffering, his own suffering and the suffering of others, but yet his sort of his childlike way of understanding things like prevents him from, even though he sees people that suffer, he doesn't understand evil. And this, it's a, you know, it's the same thing as with a kid, like when they don't understand that evil is present, they also can't understand love. Like it's tied up. And he has that same problem. Like, I think at the end of the novel, like it's strange because he really has no attachment to anything, even after all of this sort of emotional turmoil.
Yes, I agree. No, I think that's right. And perhaps it, along with that inability to, that, I mean, with what seems like a positive ability to transcend shame and transcend guilt, comes an inability to recognize evil.
So right? I think the narrator comments towards the end at one point that he completely misjudged, it's either Aglaya or it's Pavlovich or somebody who says that he completely misjudged Aglaya and Nastasya because of his inability to, you know, to understand their true character, because he doesn't want to see evil in other people.
That's Yevgeny Pavlovich Radomsky. Mm-hmm. And that's an important speech, and we should look at that later on. But Radomsky has a couple of those, you know, just laser sharp speeches that he gives that are maybe a little too clearly focused. Good points of view nonetheless. All right. So, yes. Uh-huh.
I was wondering, do you have to say, though, that Mishkin does say something about Nastasya that is true, that isn't generally seen? And the reason why I think this has to be the case is there's that scene where she comes in to kind of shame Ganya in front of his family.
Yes.
And sort of makes the most out of his vanity and all of that. And it seems like he tells her, you're not really like this. And then it's sort of like that, she changes in that scene, and then she goes, she kisses the hand of his mother, and she sort of says, the prince is right about it. And then she just kind of runs off.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it seemed like, you know, trying to understand Nastasya, I guess, but.
Yes. No, that's very important. That he does see something, apparently, that no one else sees. But what does he do with it?
Right.
So he seems to be in the position of one who is meant to speak to her and to change her in some way. But by telling her, you're not to blame, what he gets eventually, she's very attracted to that, as obviously she would be, very hungry to hear this, but at the same time, at the end of the day, as the cliche has it nowadays, she says, ruin a child like that, you know, because she's known all along that this person is not all there. He doesn't see the whole picture. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just sort of going off that comment, it seems like that could sort of be Mishkin's problem throughout the entire novel, is seeing things and understanding things to some extent and then not knowing what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost what's coming out in his epileptic fits, because just before then, he'll get a moment of like intense perception and understanding of everything, unlike what other people do, like not ever have.
That's interesting.
But then
he
can't deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is just like total physical and mental debilitation.
So both of you are suggesting that Mishkin is in some way a source of insight, or is meant to be a source of insight. I've even of new insight.
But
he
doesn't have, he can't get
it
back. Could that relate back to Hamlet? Is that brought up in this book? I don't know.
If it isn't, it should be.
Maybe I've got
two. Mentioned, yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know. I forgot.
Both Hamlet and Don Quixote are mentioned in the course of the novel.
I would think Mishkin might credibly be mentioned as a certain kind of as a Turgenevian Hamlet, at any rate, one who can't make up his mind and so forth. But
Yevgeny says of the prince that from the start something symbolically democratic and he has this in italics. He says, I put it this way for the sake of brevity. Entered into his thought about, he says it's about Nastasia, but I assume it means about people in general. Can you unpack that a little bit? Symbolically democratic ideas?
Perhaps when we get to that, let's take a look and see what are the main scenes in the second part of the novel that we ought to go back and look, re-examine, go back and look at more carefully. It seems to me in part three, part three is dominated by a long solo performance, and this is Hippolyte's monologue. Right? And we should look at this because, wow, it poses many, many perplexities about it. You know, what to make of Hippolyte? Is there a way to sum him up at all, otherwise than to say, in a sense, that he's brilliant, perhaps, or what? And why are all those who listen to him so put off by him? You know, what a strange scene that this all happens. And this Hippolyte's monologue also has dreams within the monologue, and so forth, that stories within them, and so forth, that we need to look at carefully, because they're giving us analogs for the action of the story. And in part four, then again, part four, not quite with the gathering slowly of momentum and returning finally to that pace that we had in part one of actions following upon actions. We get, first of all, that concentration on Ganya and his family, and leading to General Ivolgin's curse of his family, a curse upon this house, his raving, his stroke, right? The whole story of the demise of General Ivolgin all can be looked at as one continuous episode. And then after that, the party, Mishkin's party, the party for Mishkin, I guess I should say, as the central longest scene in part four. Everything comes out of that, the disaster of that, that slowly and inevitably led up to, there's a point during the party in which we feel like, oh no, you know, I can't get out of the tractor beam. It's all going to happen, you know, no matter what. And then Aglaya goes to meet with Nastasia Filipovna. And then the wedding, the interrupted wedding, the inverted wedding, and then finally, of course, the death scene. So all of those, very different part three and part four. Part four packed with crucial action. So let's take a look at some of these things and see what it is that Dostoevsky means to portray. The story of Hippolyte is a very uneconomic way of saying anything about Mishkin, it seems, right? So what is it that that makes that so so necessary for it to occupy the large place that it does in the novel? Let's go back and look at it. It starts around page 420, and if you're in your modern library edition, I'm going to be looking at it in a different edition. It's starts with in part three, chapter five, and we know that he's just been talking with Mishkin at this gathering, and he, after giving the title of his article that he's going to read them, he out and out says that Mishkin answered that had always been a materialist. Right, so we get a confession about Mishkin that Mishkin himself has not given. Right. So this is right at the very beginning, where he gives his title, and I have 420 for your page number, and after that it says that when I told him I should die just the same, looking at trees or looking out of my window, right, at brick walls, he agreed at once. But the greenness and the fresh air will be sure, according to him, to produce a physical change in me, in my excitement, and my dreams will be affected and perhaps relieved. I told him again, laughing, that he spoke like a materialist. He answered with his smile that he had always been a materialist. As he never tells a lie, that saying means something. Okay, so first of all, let me point out something about, and this you will get from Bakhtin, although as Dr. Dupree was saying to me earlier today, Bakhtin scarcely mentions the idiot. It's interesting how he seems to avoid talking about the idiot. One of the key structural devices that Dostoevsky relies on, and again, this is not something that he got out of a textbook or something, but it seems to well up from within him, is what Bakhtin calls the threshold dialogue. And this he relates to sources, ancient sources, as no less august than Plato's Apology, the Apology of Socrates. In other words, the impassioned speech given on at the threshold of death or of some drastic change, in which it's a situation that enforces people to set aside their ordinary restraints and to say what they really think, right? That to bring out, and that's most Dostoevskian of situations, because this is always what Dostoevsky wants, for the situation to, not to restrain, but to constrain people into bringing out what they truly think and truly believe. So Ippolites is a long-sustained threshold dialogue, as he insists he's on the point of death, less so than he actually thinks, it turns out, of course, but we see by the end of that that his intention was to kill himself after this talk. So my final word about everything, with no worry about the consequences, in other words. Right? And you see, right, and so that leads into, often, though, not to a question just of an impulsive explosion of spleen or whatever. Here's what I'm mad about, right, and so forth. Your typical comedy monologue, but rather to a general consideration. Well, what, after all is said and done, do I truly believe? Right. So Ippolite is facing this, and it's in marked contrast to Mishkin, who's not facing anything. Right. We don't see Mishkin able to have something like a threshold dialogue. We see a parody of that at the party given for him. So that's perhaps one kind of relation. And in saying that Mishkin speaks like a materialist, you remember the importance of Meyer's Wall, and I hope you remembered that for your quiz. Meyer's Wall as something that he wanted to be close to, right? Why? Because it was something. It was concrete, so to speak. Not to be, you know, punning, I suppose, but that it was... it was real, right? Whereas the thing about having a nice pastoral setting to die in, you know, it doesn't have any personal relation. Doesn't reveal me as a person. You know, it's simply a thought that someone might say, "Well, that's in general. That's needed. That provides good blood pressure and heart rate and so forth. It will influence your dreams in a good way." He says, "You speak like a materialist." You say, "Well, yes, I am a materialist." So. Materialists, right, in the sense that the body and soul are split very much in the way that they were since Descartes. So yes, ma'am, you had your hand up.
It was just that he actually does get better. I mean,
well, he does. This is true.
You know, when he is around
right.
The trees.
Right. Mm-hmm. Good point. So it's not false, but it's we're just interested in seeing the difference. Yes.
You say he means materialism in the sense that body and soul are split, like in Descartes.
That's what I said.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I heard you right, because that was like, what? I was just confused for a second.
I mean, I'm not so sure that, although we never see, well, we rarely see, we see Michigan refer to Christ, but we don't see a whole lot of references to life of the Spirit. He would have a good reason to be materialist, right? if he is so dominated by epileptic seizures, right, and to how much influence they have over your own mind, one's mind and one's insides. So that's got to be something that Dostoevsky himself struggled with as well. But all right, what about the dream? The strange insect-like creature. And all of that. Any comments on that?
Refining.
I'm sorry?
It was so grotesque. The whole reading it was just very unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Very dark, Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
Well,
423. Okay, thank you. This, you know, the whole scorpion-like insect. How does our modern language translate that? What's it like? Did it say a scorpion?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But yes, on the same time, it sort of looks like a tripod or a trident or something. So.
It's got arms but no legs. So
right.
It's like got.
Yeah.
It crawls like a snake, but it's got two arms.
Yeah.
Gorgon, that's what I was thinking.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like a gorgon.
Well, Dostoevsky has truly conjured up the grotesque here. Legs wriggled like little snakes and so forth, right? So that he's terrified by it. But what happens in the dream?
Isn't it his childhood dog, or his, like, the dog from his family?
Mm-hmm.
The scorpion stings it.
Right. It comes and rescues it,
yeah.
Everybody from it, stands off this horrible insect and gets it in his jaws, but the thing stings it.
Yeah, but in the end of that struggle.
Yeah. So, I mean, what does that sound like? Anybody? Does that give you any sort of flashbacks to?
It's
yes.
Kind of like the dead Christ, the whole line picture where the Christ has been like flogged and tortured, and you can see the suffering, but it's redemptive. And here the dog comes in and saves it. And it, like, but he has this whole, well, he was commenting on the Christ figure, and I guess I don't really know what the correlation is, but that's what I thought of. It's like. In his dream, he's getting rescued. I don't know.
Yeah. The dog is the only redemptive figure in the in the novel. The only truly effective one, right? It's all a symbolic figure, right, of course. But it is a symbolic figure. He's dreaming of these archetypes. And what is it said of... yes, uh-huh.
I think that's interesting, but... and I agree, but I think it's sort of weird that, you know, you mentioned the painting, but isn't another place it says, like, you know, you have, like, nature's, like, crushing Christ, right? Like, we mentioned that, you said that. And here you have the black dog,
mm-hmm.
like, the black background. I don't know. It seemed very odd to me, that sort of, the parallel, you know, that the dog is, this is very perverse, I know, but, like, the dog is, like, crushing the scorpion.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, like, the darkness is kind of crushing the image of the Christ. In the painting?
I forgot that. Yeah, uh-huh, yes, okay.
I mean, you also have the parallel that the scorpion has two hands and his feet are, like, his hand, he just has one tail.
Well, it's certainly true that the image of Christ in Holbein has no power. Christ has no power at all in that image. Right, so that would be like one polarity. And the other would be of this triumphant warrior Christ, perhaps, who vanquishes the devil. Who is it said about in Christian lore? I mean, this should be the right college to ask this question.
St. George, St. Michael?
Is it St. Michael? Who is it? Wounds the, stabs the devil through the serpent through the heart, while the serpent bites its foot.
Michael?
Is that?
It could be either, because they both, there's the image of that. I mean, you have St. George and the dragon.
Yeah. Well, y'all should know.
We're talking about the apocalypse, though, right? And in Revelation, it's Michael.
So it's this is the apocalypse. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are threads here to examine. If you want to examine this novel, there's a great deal here to be looking at. I'm thinking Hippolyte, though, it's a bit almost to his credit that he has a dream like this, right? Because it exposes a heroic archetype as genuine inside his own mind, inside his own unconscious. He goes on, and in chapter 6 he tells a story about the man who dropped his pocketbook, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. As try as he might, he can't get the man to even notice him, and then he has to go into this poverty-stricken apartment and so forth, and it goes on, and at first they take offense and so forth. Again, it's a story of efficacy. You know, in a novel full of ineffectuality, right, in which he is goes on and actually reunites the man with his pocketbook, has to fight the man's anger at first, and then he's very, very grateful, and turns out why, not only that, but he can be helpful in getting him a connection as a doctor and so forth. All of this happens. Now, Hippolyte is an 18-year-old, right, with a highly cynical attitude about life, certain that he's going to die soon, yet he has this kind of, effective attitude toward life. So, and meanwhile, he's telling these things, and everybody's just really ticked off at him. They're like, "Why are you boring us with this long story that has no point? I don't get it. I want to go home. I've drunk too much. I'm and so forth." It's so that Dostoevsky always frames his story in another layer of meaning and irony. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What page is the pocketbook story on?
Oh, that's all chapter 6.
That's all chapter 6.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, do you think, I mean, it sort of seems like, as you're saying, like, that the dream is an image, is the Hippolyte's dream about the dog and the scorpion. Do you think you could see that as a small image for Mishkin in the book? I mean, in the end, he doesn't die, but he reverts to, like, his previous idiocy, and he's sort of failed Aglaya and failed Nastasia.
Perhaps. And there's some kind of polarity, of course, between Mishkin and Rogozhin, but neither is meant to be a symbol of total good and total evil, or total evil.
Yeah.
But perhaps we're meant to be reminded that whereas that struggle to, the mortal struggle goes on, notice how Mishkin and Rogozhin end up with each other. Very, very fascinating. And this reminds me that I'm running behind. We could get into this Hippolyte's dream, Hippolyte's dialogue for hours, couldn't we? But we got to go on and look at some other important scenes. So, and I'm going to skip the general's demise, because it's wonderful, it's terrible. The whole story of being Napoleon's page. Oh, you just feel for the guy. But notice that Mishkin is one of those who laughs at him, right? We see that this happens in the chapter where that story comes out, and that's part 4, chapter 4, of all the characters. Basically, he dies because he is led to his... dies at that moment. He's probably destined to die pretty soon. But is outraged at everyone in his house who laughs at him in his own house. Mishkin is one of those who laughs at him in his own house. And it says explicitly that he laughs for several minutes in a row, right, at his absurd story. So, again, another episode in which Mishkin does not do anything that is, we think more highly of him for. Incidentally, what does he advise Hippolyte to do? Does he try to convince Hippolyte not to kill himself? No. He says something like, "Pass by us and forgive us our happiness." Right? It's kind of a bogus translation of the gospel, right? Kind of a New Age translation of the gospel. Forgive us our happiness. Amazing, amazing insight here that Dostoevsky has. But these currents are already in the air in that ultra-modern city of Petersburg in the 1860s. We go on to the party. I mean, remember, it's prefaced by Aglaya coming to Mishkan. And think of this also, that the courtship between Mishkan and Aglaya. And there's a point at which earlier on in the novel, Mishkan has said, I can feel a new life. I can feel that I'm entering a new life now. You know. So is it possible that he, as a character, is longing for incarnation? Because at that point that he says, I'm longing for new life, that I'm entering a new life, what's happened to him just at that moment is there's the possibility of his engagement to Aglaya. At the same time, there seems to also be a possibility that somebody's going to challenge him to a duel, or somebody's going to challenge someone to a duel. It's unclear at that moment. So we have almost the most raw aspects of sex and violence brought to him at that point. You know, there's hope. In a sense, he expresses a hope, right? And I think from time to time he expresses a hope for, you know, a normal life. This is why he's drawn towards these absurd things like engagement with Aglaya, declaring he wants to marry Nastasya, letting himself go to this giant coming out party for him, right? That all of which he says, the kinds of things that he said earlier in the novel that he's not suited for. Right? He lets these things happen to him. There is a longing in him. We can't simply dismiss him as if it were a satiric portrait by Dostoevsky, because it is not. It's not simply something in which Dostoevsky is showing how absurd all these new ideas are, or something like that. He has embodied a character who has his own longing, his own desire. And we sense that, too. And if we, again, like as we do for all novelistic characters, we have to feel that sympathy for him just as well. But it should not blind us to what he does. So in the party, you know, and remember that Aglaya has said to him, you know, I just know you're going to break the Chinese vase. And he says, now that you've said it, I'm afraid I'm going to break the Chinese vase. And then she finally says, well, be sure to break the Chinese vase. Do. And again, I hope that was, hope you did well on that in your quiz. you know, so that the determinism of these things, the scripted nature, nothing could be more scripted than this moment that Dr. Dupree was saying. Something strangely allegorical about it. And there's something strangely that examines consciousness also with us, that we, when the thing that we fear the most is the thing that we sidle toward always. Edgar Allan Poe examined this in a ridiculous story, but for Dostoevsky, it's part of this profound tapestry of consciousness. And so he goes in, and at first impression, he makes a big hit. Right, everyone thinks he's wonderful. And that, however, gives bad feedback to him, because it's like, ah, now people accept me. They must be truly wonderful. You know, and he's mistaken, suave and smooth manners of the upper class for really being that nice, you know, which, you know, is a really naive mistake. And so he puts himself at ease and decides he'll tell them what he really thinks. And it gets more and more manic. And we get more and more apprehensive as it goes on. And we have that wonderful tirade against Catholicism that takes place in Part 4, Chapter 7, the Romanism that is, again, strangely, is a little bit of a parody, of a self-parody of Dostoevsky's own views, because Dostoevsky was an anti-ultramontanist. He was one who did not trust those desires for empire that the Catholic Church had historically shown that it wanted, right, and wanted to remain free of that, and was therefore, of course, always tied to the Orthodox Church. But Mishkan goes too far, and these things are not said at parties, and so forth. Right? It's amazing. And then in the highest moment of frenzy, he breaks the vase. And lo and behold, you know, we already feel that the worst has happened. But no, that's just a foreshadowing. Right? And then laughter ensues, and it all might be all right. You know, because anything, you can do something bad as an accident. So, you know, real manners will glide over the moment. It can all be taken care of later. and so forth. But he again takes the wrong message from that, as if everything really is all right. Your souls are so capacious, you've accepted me completely. You know, so he goes on, and finally, of course, he slides into this grand seizure. So we have almost a mythic dimension to this party. It's come together as a celebration, as a wedding feast or something, a pre-wedding feast, and it ends as a as an assault on the spirit of parties. Everyone leaves in a horrible mood. The one woman that they had hoped to impress, what's her name? Madame Bielokonski, Princess Bielokonski, says, well, there has some good and some bad in him, but there's more of bad than of good. Wow.
Is that supposed to be our assessment?
No, that's supposed to be Princess Bielokonski's assessment. And she is, of course, remember, Madame and General Yepanchin are nice, well-off people. They are, would you call them gentry, or, you know, are they more like lower aristocracy?
Or somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there, but they're, you know, they're yearning always to climb a little bit on the ladder. They want to impress people above them favorably, right? So they hold these parties, and the Princess Bielokonski, it had already been said, is the one that they want to impress. And Dostoevsky has I think, quite well described how people who are the object of this kind of desire feel, that they themselves feel rather, you know, rather neutral, cool towards the Yepanchins. And if they hear about something, if they're on their own and they hear about some terrible disaster that has befallen, they're neutral about it, right? But if they're ever, you know, but they'll accept all the compliments and all the favors and so forth from the general. So, you know, this sort of social desire is also something that Dostoevsky is so good at portraying. But that's in the background. It could have all been managed in this scene. It could have all been skated over. But it all erupts and explodes in this one amazing scene. Well, and then we have to look at the last scene. Really, which is unlike the others because it's so quiet. It's so complete in itself. It doesn't leave all these tags of possible further meanings, but it's just as though it says everything that can be said. And after Nastasya has suddenly turned 180 degrees and run out toward the crowd and run toward Rogozhin and his carriage and disappeared, then Mishkin sees Rogozhin on the street, and Rogozhin calls him to come back to his place. And we see this. It's on page 657. As he says, it's dark here, he said. There's enough to see, muttered Rogozhin. I can scarcely see. A bed. We'll get closer then, Rogozhin suggested softly. The prince stepped closer. One step, then another, and stopped. He stood still and peered at it for a minute or two. Neither of them uttered a word all the while they stood by the bedside. The prince's heart beat so violently that it seemed as though it were audible in the room, with the room's death-like stillness. But his eyes had already grown acclimated so that he could make out the whole bed. Someone lay asleep on it, in a perfectly motionless sleep. Not the faintest stir, not the faintest breath could be heard. The sleeper was covered over from head to foot with a white sheet. The limbs were vaguely defined somehow. All that could be seen from the elevation was that a human figure was lying there, stretched out. All around, in disorder, on the bed, at the feet, beside the bed, on chairs, and even on the floor, discarded clothes had been flung about. A luxurious white silk dress, flowers, ribbons. On a little table by the headboard glittered some diamonds that had been taken off and flung down. At the foot, some lace had been crumpled into a heap. And on the white lace, peeping out from under the sheet, the tip of a naked foot was revealed. It appeared as if carved out of marble, and was terribly still. The prince looked and felt that the more he looked, the more deathly still and quiet it became in the room. Suddenly a fly that had awakened began to buzz, but flew over the bed and settled by the headboard. The prince started. Let's go out. The change with which Dostoevsky writes this scene, we know before he says it what's there. The sculptural care with which he devotes to this scene. This is one of the iconic scenes that are praised in Dostoevsky. It doesn't have to be unpacked, interpreted. Every detail tells us something. And yet we're not done. It's followed with the dialogue between Rogozhin and the prince. And there, it's there. And the prince, strangely, is never shocked, never outraged, never fearful. Doesn't seem to have any motives that would be practical motives that would come naturally into a mind of you or me in such a situation. But asks and is interested when Rogozhin tells about how he did it and how he's keeping the smell away and so forth. And we go on. And so the calm between them seems both an unnaturally, almost a deranged calm, but it seems part of the scene as well. And then the long silence, and the last two pages of that chapter, pages 662 and 663 in this edition, in the middle of the page, the prince sat down on a chair and began looking at him with terror. Half an hour passed. Suddenly Rogozhin cried out loudly and abruptly and roared with laughter as though he had forgotten that they must speak in a whisper. That officer, do you remember how she lashed that officer at the bandstand? Remember? And the cadet rushed up too. The prince jumped up from the chair in new alarm. When Rogozhin grew quiet, and he suddenly grew quiet, the prince bent softly over him, sat down beside him, and with his heart beating violently and his breath strained, began to scrutinize him. Rogozhin did not turn his head toward him and seemed indeed to have forgotten about him. The prince watched and waited. Time was passing. It was beginning to get light. From time to time, Rogozhin began infrequently and all of a sudden to mutter loudly, harshly, and incoherently. He began shouting and laughing, and goes on. And the last details there, or meanwhile it had become quite light. At last he lay down on the pillow as though in utter helplessness and despair and pressed his face to the pale and motionless face of Rogozhin. Tears flowed from his eyes onto Rogozhin's cheeks, but perhaps he no longer noticed his own tears then and no longer knew anything about them. Well, this is certainly the most poignant for all the characters involved. The unspeakable death of Nastasya, but the moments that follow, there is a reconciliation of a sort between the murderer and the prince. His would-be victim, right? Remember that earlier Rogozhin had tried to kill Mishkin. And what about those tears? In a novel that had this archetypal symbolism that's run throughout. You notice how there was no blood when he stabs her. Right? So it's like a bloodless sacrifice at the altar. What should have been a marriage. There is finally some kind of union between the opposites, Mishkin and Rogozhin. And it's in those tears. And by that time, both of them have lost their minds. So it's a dark and severe portrait, but in a sense, perhaps this confirms that Mishkin has been longing for reunification in someone, and that in a strange and bizarre way, he achieves it here, for no good to himself. But as we last word of the chapter is idiot, right? And that's what he has now become definitively. It's a very dark ending, and one not entirely without strange hopeful musings, perhaps, that Dovzhev gives us, not just our symbolism, but then in the epilogue, a few people who were affected well by Mishkin, including Kolya, and Vera Lyubedya, and others.
Okay. Sorry to keep you over.